Welcome back, everybody. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
Today, we're taking a trip through American law, exploring its quirks and how it all evolved.
Should be interesting. It's a pretty winding path.
Oh, yeah. We'll be uncovering how things we see as totally normal, you know, like jury trials, actually have roots going all the way back to medieval English villages.
Yeah.
And get this. One judge used a Kentucky murder case as a springboard to explain the entire history of juries going all the way back to ancient Greece.
Wow.
It's going to be a wild ride, that's for sure.
It really is amazing how much of American law isn't just like written down in one place, you know?
Right.
It's something that developed over centuries, shaped by people, their disagreements.
Yeah.
And sometimes even just the whims of royalty.
Speaking of things we think we know, let's start with juries.
Yeah.
I mean, the basic idea is pretty simple, right?
Yeah.
But our sources dug up some pretty surprising origins.
Oh, like what?
Apparently, American jury trials are modeled after these gatherings in medieval England, where villagers would, like, meet under an oak tree to settle their differences.
Yeah, it's true. Picture a village right after the Norman conquest, back in 1066.
Okay.
Instead of relying on some far-off authority, it was the villagers themselves, like their peers, who'd hear the arguments and use their common sense to decide what happened.
Hmm. So it was really all about practicality.
Yeah, and about everyone in the community having a role.
That sounds almost casual, though, like just a neighborhood meeting.
Right.
But this is where common law comes in, right?
Exactly. These early decisions made in villages all across England became precedents.
Okay.
And those precedents influenced later cases. Over time, traveling judges started making the rounds, bringing a bit more structure and consistency to the whole process.
So things became a little more formal.
Yeah, more standardized. And that led to the concept of stare decisis, a Latin term meaning to stand by things decided.
Latin fancy.
It basically means that the precedents set by earlier cases have real weight in future rulings.
So America basically inherits this common law system.
Mm-hmm.
But our sources point out a key difference, something that's often missed in news reports.
What's that?
The difference between a jury's verdict,
right,
and a judge's judgment.
Oh, that's a really important distinction. The jury, acting as the peers of the people involved, gives a verdict based on the evidence they've heard,
yeah,
and their understanding of the law as explained by the judge.
Right, right.
But it's ultimately the judge who makes the final judgment. They can actually modify or even completely overturn a jury's verdict.
Really?
Yeah, if they believe it's not legally sound.
Okay, so thinking about juries and those, you know, common sense rulings, the McDonald's hot coffee case comes to mind.
Oh, yeah.
It became this huge media sensation.
Mm-hmm.
But our sources suggest there's more to the story than just a woman getting millions because of spilled coffee.
Absolutely. The case is often used to criticize what people see as frivolous lawsuits. But if you dig a little deeper, it becomes clear that the jury's decision, while seeming extreme at first, was rooted in a genuine concern for safety.
Mm.
The evidence showed that McDonald's was serving coffee at a dangerously high temperature, like seriously hot, and it had caused a lot of burn injuries.
So it wasn't just a one-time thing.
No, not at all.
So the jury's decision and all the media buzz it created
actually
forced McDonald's to make a change.
That's right. They lowered the temperature of their coffee.
Wow.
It also spurred a lot of discussion about corporate responsibility and product safety.
So this case that people might have seen as frivolous actually had a real impact.
Yeah.
And it all goes back to this ancient idea of common law.
It really does show you how common law adapts and evolves, sometimes in surprising ways.
It also reminds us to look beyond those attention-grabbing headlines.
Definitely.
And consider the nuances of these legal cases. What might seem outrageous at first can reveal deeper issues when you look closer. And it can even lead to positive change.
You got it.
Okay, so common law, with its focus on precedent and evolving with each case, is one pillar of American law.
Mm-hmm.
But our sources point to another layer, the development of equity alongside common law.
Yeah.
Now, this sounds interesting.
It is. This is where things get a bit more, shall we say, royal.
Yeah. Okay. Let's hear it.
Imagine this. The King of England wants a divorce, but common law doesn't allow for it.
Not though.
Or think about those early explorers who wanted to invest in ventures to the new world.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were afraid of losing everything if things went south.
Makes sense.
So what did they do?
I'm guessing they couldn't just go to their local village court.
Nope. They needed another option.
So they appealed directly to the king.
You got it.
Wow, going straight to the top. Then wouldn't that create chaos?
You'd think so, right?
How did the king manage this whole new system without undermining everything that was already in place?
You're right. It was a delicate balance. To handle these unusual cases, the king, working through his chancellor, developed a whole separate system called equity. It ran alongside the common law courts.
Oh, okay.
But it provided remedies, solutions, where common law just didn't cut it.
So it was like a safety valve.
In a way, yes. The king got his divorce.
Of course he did.
Those early investors got limited liability through the creation of corporations.
Interesting.
And with all that, a new avenue for seeking legal solutions was born.
So equity basically stepped in where common law couldn't. That's fascinating.
Right.
Did this lead to new types of legal actions?
It did. This is where we see things like injunctions pop up.
Injunctions?
Yeah, court orders that prevent someone from doing something specific.
Oh, okay.
It was a powerful tool, especially in situations that needed immediate action.
Exactly.
Or where just getting money back wasn't enough to solve the problem.
And what's really interesting is that our sources say this division between common law and equity.
Yeah.
It's still around in the American legal system today.
It's true. Equity cases, like those dealing with injunctions or big corporate disputes, they're often decided by judges, not by juries. It reflects how those matters were originally decided, you know, through that direct appeal to the king's authority.
So we've got this mix of medieval English traditions,
right.
Royal interventions,
exactly,
all shaping the very foundation of American law. It's definitely not as simple as just opening a law book, that's for sure.
It's way more complicated than that. And to make it even more interesting, the story doesn't stop there.
Of course not. It never does.
Remember, America started with 13 different colonies.
Right.
Each with its own unique legal heritage.
This is where I imagine things get really, really complicated.
Oh, you're telling me.
We're about to step into a real legal labyrinth. But first, we got to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back, ready to plunge headfirst into this labyrinth that is American law. We've already journeyed from, like, medieval English villages to the king's court. But now we're stepping into colonial America.
Each of those 13 original colonies brought their own distinct legal traditions, creating this fascinating mix of ideas that ultimately shaped the whole American legal system.
It's like a legal melting pot. Yeah. Simmering with all these different ingredients.
It really is.
Our sources mention Virginia's aristocratic system, New England's super strict Puritan laws. Where else did these influences come from?
Well, Pennsylvania, with its Quaker roots, really emphasized minimal government intervention. You know, keeping things simple.
Okay.
While Maryland, under Lord Baltimore's influence, developed a more structured legal system. Their focus was really on property rights.
Interesting.
And down south, especially in places like Louisiana and Florida, you see traces of French and Spanish law. Wow. So all these different legal ideas came across the ocean with the settlers. And then they had to figure out how to unite all these colonies under one nation.
Exactly. It was a huge challenge.
How did the U.S. Constitution, this document born out of compromise and debate, address this patchwork of legal systems?
The main goal of the Constitution was to establish a federal government with limited but very clearly defined powers. It created a framework for national unity, but intentionally left most legal matters to the individual states.
So that decentralized approach was baked in from the beginning.
It was, and it's had a huge impact on how American law developed. But of course, it also created complexities. Especially when it came to things like, well, slavery.
That's a really important point. Our sources highlight how the Constitution, by legally defining slaves as property, actually made a deeply unjust system even more entrenched.
It's a tragic example of how law, even when it's trying to create order, can be used to reinforce inequality.
It's a stark reminder that even legal frameworks, which might seem neutral on the surface, can reflect and even amplify societal biases, leading to terrible consequences.
Absolutely. The way slaves were defined as property had a lasting impact. It shaped not only the course of American history, but also the ongoing fight for racial justice that we're still grappling with today.
So we have this intricate web of legal systems inherited from England and made even more diverse by the experiences of each colony. And then, to add another layer, we have the Constitution trying to bring some order to the mix, while also dealing with incredibly difficult issues like slavery.
It's no wonder American law can feel like a maze.
It's definitely intricate.
Yeah.
And to make things even more interesting, the story doesn't end there. As the nation expanded, new states joined the Union, each bringing their own legal ideas and practices. It's like the tapestry of American law just kept getting richer and more complex.
It did, and still does today.
Okay, I need to take a breath. For the average person trying to navigate this legal landscape, where do they even start? It can feel so overwhelming, especially with all the differences between state and federal laws.
You're absolutely right. It's not like some countries that have unified legal codes where you could theoretically find all the laws in one massive book. The U.S. system relies heavily on what's called case law.
Case law.
Yeah, those precedents we were talking about earlier, basically past court decisions shape how future cases are decided.
So it's like building a house without knowing how to read blueprints. You might think you have the general idea, but without understanding the technical details, you're probably going to mess things up.
Exactly. And because of that, legal research becomes a very specialized skill. It often requires the expertise of, well, legal professionals.
That makes sense. Is that why it's so hard to find, like, basic legal information in the news? You don't really see regular everyday law columns in American newspapers.
Exactly. What might be legal in one state could be completely different in another. Even something as seemingly straightforward as writing a will can become complicated because state laws vary so much.
And you can't even always rely on those legal software programs.
Right. Those programs can be helpful, but they often struggle to keep up with all the little differences in state regulations. It's a minefield.
So for someone who's not a legal expert but might have to deal with some legal stuff at some point, what's the best approach?
Honestly, don't be afraid to get professional guidance. Talking to a lawyer can be a huge help. They can make sure you understand your rights and what you're obligated to do, especially when you're facing something complex or unfamiliar. It might seem like an expense, but it can save you a lot of time, money, and stress down the road.
That's good advice. But beyond the practical side of things, what about just understanding the basics of the legal system? We hear all these terms thrown around, like torts and damages, but without context, it can sound like a completely foreign language.
Oh, absolutely. Legal jargon can be intimidating, even for native English speakers. Take the word damages, for instance.
Okay.
It can refer to the harm someone suffers, A&D, the monetary compensation they might get for that harm. It's easy to get mixed up.
Oh, I see what you mean. It's like that video I saw where people were asked to define torts, and most of them thought it had something to do with cake.
Exactly. It shows how much of a gap there is between legal language and everyday language. And while making legal terminology easier to understand is important, you also have to remember that legal concepts often have very specific, nuanced meanings that are hard to capture in simple terms.
So it's a balancing act, right? Making the law understandable, but also preserving its precision.
Exactly. It's a tough one to get right.
Okay, so we've explored the development of common law and equity, the impact of colonial legal traditions, and the challenges of navigating this decentralized legal system with variations in state laws. But there's one element we touched on earlier that I want to dig into a bit more. The Constitution's attempt to balance state autonomy with the need for consistent justice across the entire nation. It's something that keeps coming up, especially when we're talking about how vulnerable individuals can be to local biases.
You're right. That's a key point. The framers of the Constitution were very concerned about the potential for injustice within a system that gave so much power to individual states. They knew firsthand how local prejudices could affect legal outcomes, sometimes with really damaging results.
It's like that saying, justice is blind. But in reality, it often felt like justice was looking through a very narrow lens, one that was shaped by local customs and biases.
Absolutely. And to address that, the Constitution established what's called a dual court system. This means we have both state courts, which handle most legal issues, and federal courts, which oversee federal law and disputes between different states.
So this dual court system was designed to ensure that people could seek justice beyond their own communities.
Exactly. It's like having two layers of protection. Picture our witch, again, worried about being persecuted for her beliefs, or our traveling salesman who's concerned about facing a biased court far from home. The Constitution gave them another option, the possibility of seeking justice in a federal court, somewhere where local prejudices might not be as strong.
That's fascinating. So how exactly did the Constitution put these protections in place? What mechanisms allowed people to access federal courts?
Well, there are a couple of key ways this works. One is called federal question jurisdiction.
Federal question jurisdiction.
Yeah. It basically means that if a case involves an issue of federal law or a violation of someone's constitutional rights, it can be heard in a federal court. it goes straight to the federal judges, bypassing potential local bias.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about that traveling salesman scenario we were talking about, where someone's worried about facing a biased court in a state where they don't actually live?
That's where diversity jurisdiction comes in.
Diversity jurisdiction.
Yeah. If a citizen from one state sues someone from another state, they can often choose to have their case heard in a federal court instead of state court.
Oh, I see.
The goal is to provide a neutral playing field, you know, to avoid any potential hometown advantage that a state court might give.
Those safeguards are so important.
Mm.
They really show how the framers of the Constitution understood that justice can be fragile, especially in a system that values state autonomy.
They did. It was a balancing act.
But determining which court actually has the power to hear a case, that can get really complicated, can't it? Our sources mentioned something called personal jurisdiction.
Oh, yeah.
And how it relates to the legal reach of courts across state lines.
Ah, you're getting into some really nuanced territory now. Personal jurisdiction refers to a court's authority to hear a case involving a specific defendant. And it can get especially tricky when you're dealing with things like online activity, internet transactions.
Because it's not always clear where those activities are actually taking place.
Exactly. For example, courts are still figuring out whether sending an email to someone in another state or posting something online that someone in another state sees can justify you being sued in that other state. It's a whole new world of legal questions.
It sounds like figuring out jurisdiction, especially in this digital age, is like a constantly moving target.
It really is. We're all still figuring it out as we go.
We've covered so much ground in this deep dive, from those early common law juries to the complexities of federal jurisdiction in America today.
We have. It's been quite a ride.
But before we wrap up, I want to touch on one last point that our sources emphasize: the enduring impact of those colonial legal traditions on the American legal landscape.
It's amazing how the legal seeds planted by those early settlers continue to shape how we approach law in this country, even centuries later.
And we're back, ready to wrap up our deep dive into this fascinating and often confusing world of American law.
It's been quite the journey, hasn't it?
It really has. We started way back with those juries gathering under oak trees in medieval England.
Right.
And we've made our way through centuries of legal evolution, exploring how common law developed, how equity emerged to fill in the gaps, and how the U.S. Constitution tried to create some kind of unified framework while still respecting the independence of each state.
It's a delicate balance, that's for sure.
And one that's still playing out today, especially when you consider how to ensure equal justice for everyone in a system that gives so much power to individual states.
That tension between state autonomy and the need for consistent justice nationwide is something we keep coming back to.
It's a theme that really runs through the whole history of American law. And the framers of the Constitution, they were definitely aware of the potential for things to go wrong.
Oh, yeah. They knew that if you left legal decisions entirely to local authorities, well, things could get pretty messy.
They saw how local prejudices and biases could creep into legal outcomes, sometimes with devastating consequences.
Exactly. And to guard against that, they built in safeguards like federal question jurisdiction and diversity jurisdiction.
Right, right. Those mechanisms, as we've been discussing, allow people to take their case to a federal court, potentially escaping the influence of those local biases.
It's like having a backup plan, you know? If you're worried you won't get a fair shake in your own community, you can appeal to a higher authority.
So going back to our witch and our traveling salesman, the Constitution gave them a path to justice that went beyond their local jurisdictions. It's pretty amazing how those principles established so long ago are still relevant in legal debates today.
It really, think about all the discussions we have about things like healthcare, voting rights, environmental protection.
Yeah.
These are all areas where federal intervention is often seen as necessary to make sure everyone has equal protection under the law, regardless of where they live.
It speaks to that ongoing struggle, that push and pull between state autonomy and the need for consistent justice for everyone across the nation.
It's definitely a balancing act. And as we've seen, American law isn't this fixed, unchanging thing. It's constantly evolving, adapting to new challenges and societal shifts.
Okay, so if someone's listening to this and thinking, wow, American law is really complicated, what are the big takeaways? What's the key message they should walk away with?
Well, first and foremost, recognize that American law is this incredible tapestry woven from so many different historical threads. It's a blend of English common law, those interventions by the king through equity, and the lasting influence of those diverse colonial legal traditions.
It's like a recipe with layers upon layers of flavors and influences.
Exactly. And second, remember that the pursuit of justice is a journey, not a destination. It's a constant effort to make sure the law serves everyone fairly and equitably.
It's not about achieving some perfect legal utopia, but about continually striving to uphold those core principles. Fairness, due process, equal protection under the law, those are the ideals that drive this whole system.
Beautifully put. So as you navigate this complex world of law, remember that knowledge is your best tool. Don't be afraid to ask questions, seek out expert guidance when you need it, and speak up for a system that truly delivers justice for everyone.
We've explored a lot in this deep dive, from those early common law origins to the challenges of federal jurisdiction in the modern world. Hopefully, you're leaving with a better understanding of how American law works, its historical roots, and the forces that continue to shape it. And maybe, just maybe, we've sparked a curiosity to delve even deeper.
Until next time, keep those questions coming, keep learning, and keep exploring.
That's all for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.